Okay, so in terms of the class, I owe you a few things, so I'm hoping to send you some emails today. But I just sent an email with this week's writing assignment, and I need to give you last week's write-ups that you have, along with your numbers and stuff, so you can rank those. The other thing I did is, in terms of how to post your writing assignment this coming week, I now put in journals 1 through 23 or something, and I'll give you the numbers, which will be your random number for the week. I want you to submit your journal name on it to that, whichever that number is. So I know who submitted to which journal, but nobody else does. And you'll be able to see all the entries, so then I'll ask you to rank so many. Then for those rankings, I'll create a private journal where you can give me your rankings, and that will be just between you and me. But I would like you to go to those essays in the particular journal numbers that I give you to read those, and then you can put your comments there. And that way, they're basically there for you. And then you can go to your journal and read the comments with those people put there. And you're welcome to read carefully any of the journals and put comments. I think I don't have a problem with that, but I'm going to ask you to do it. Okay? Any issues about the class? Okay. So we started talking about relativity last time, and I'm going to go fairly quickly over what we talked about last time. And so one of the things was, we sort of agreed on the nature. Yeah, okay, I said really fast, right? Get rid of some of these slides. So we agreed on the basic intuitive nature of space and time that we all grew up with, where you got three dimensions that are immutable. We all perceive them to basically be the same. And those dimensions then move at a constant rate in one direction through time. All at the same. Everything goes the same rate through time. And so it doesn't matter what you're doing within that space, you're moving at the same time, and everyone will perceive you basically to be in that same part of space, per se. You may be in a different location relative to them, but... So this is sort of Newtonian physics, and it leads to very particular things like relative velocity addition, which we talked about, where if somebody's walking past you at a certain speed, and then they step on a moving sidewalk that's going at another speed, then you would perceive them, if you're off to the side, as being going past you at a velocity which is equal to the sum of the two. Right? So that's really what we grew up with. And so... we will talk a good bit about the nature of light, but it turns out that at the time relativity came about, people understood light to be a wave phenomenon, and we'll talk about the nature of that wave phenomenon, but all the waves that were known up to that point were waves that moved in mechanical media, and those were known very much to respect Newtonian relative addition, sort of like we've got. So the example that we used was, if you have a wave going on a swimming pool or something, and you see its speed, and you now walk this way, you'll reduce the speed relative to you. So relative addition works for those kinds of waves. But then you run into all sorts of funny problems, like if you know that light is a wave phenomenon, and you know that it is moves at a finite speed, both of which were known at the time Einstein came out with relativity, then you get all sorts of weirdness, like, well, what does light look like when you are moving at the speed of light, or faster than the speed of light? And there's no limit in Newtonian physics, so in principle you can do this. And Maxwell's equations, which are the mathematical equations that describe the classical theory of light that were well understood by this point, they don't really have an answer to that. So they seem to be imperfect. And to what extent Einstein was personally aware of that, of a some measurements people made where they were actually looking, trying to detect the speed of light, the relative speed of light. If light moves in a medium, they call the medium ether because it's ethereal. We don't seem to notice it. And if light is moving in that medium, then one should be able to detect the speed of light changing depending on your motion with respect to the ether. And so people looked for that. And we mentioned that Michelson Morley built a sensitive spectrometer to look for this, where they split light into two different directions, and they were looking for the change in the speed of light relative to the direction of the light propagation, where the relative speed with respect to the ether was given by the motion of the Earth, which is moving at a pretty good clip through absolute space. So they observed no difference, no dependence on the direction. And I think I've read, and although I didn't just read it, so maybe it's a little bit of recollection. I think I've read that, you know, when you go and you look at the data again, it wasn't one of these things like they made the measurement and the next day they can announce this wasn't there. It was one of those things where they tried to make the measurement and it wasn't too clear from the data because the experiment's very hard and it took some time. But in the end, they were unable to see the directional dependence of the velocity depending on the direction of the motion of Earth through space. So, in relativity, Einstein made two postulates, one of which is that the speed of light is the same in all inertial reference frames, and he either made this in part because he knew about Michelson and Morley, or he made it in part because he was trying to figure out how to actually have electromagnetism work and not have this, and I'm not sure historically exactly what he was doing with that. But in the end, he made this assumption, which the essence of which is really saying, okay, let us say that the experiment is correct, even though intuitively it makes no sense to us. We should be able to detect the speed variation with respect to our motion in the ether. And then the other thing he assumed is the physics is the same in all inertial reference frames. So if I drop an egg and it breaks, then it doesn't matter how you're moving, you're going to see the egg drop and break. And just remember when we talk about this is now physics speak, inertial means it is not accelerating, so it moves with constant speed with respect to other reference frames. And reference frame is just basically a point of view, so you can picture however you're moving, you can picture a coordinate system that moves with you, and that would be your so-called reference frame, because that's how you perceive things. And if you're standing right here, we sort of all are at rest with respect to one another. We more or less share the same reference system. And if we were driving by in a car, then we experience a reference system that's moving with respect to this one. If the car is not accelerating with respect to us, I mean, or anything else, then we would consider them to be inertial reference frames. And so then the question is, what you would like to be able to do, because science depends on our measurements, is to measure something in our inertial reference frame and ask what would that look like from some other inertial reference frame. And that is what relativity is. It's simply a relationship of what is measured in one reference frame, inertial reference frame, to what's measured in any other inertial reference frame. And so We looked at this thought experiment where Sam was on a train and he timed light going up to the ceiling, reflecting and coming back. So the light goes at a height h. The train is moving at speed v, and he measures a time t Sam. So the speed of light is 2 times this distance h divided by the time he measures. And then we looked at the same thing where Sally was concerned, and Sally is off to the side of this train going by, and miraculously, for some reason, she can actually see when the light is emitted and when it's detected. And so, when the light is emitted, she starts her stopwatch, because she has great reflexes, and then, as the light propagates up to the top, the train moves, And it has a weird path, and this weird path is now the fact that Sally and Sam have to see the same physical phenomenon. And as the light travels at finite velocity up to the top of the train has to move. So if the physical phenomenon that you observe is the fact that the light is emitted, bounces, and is detected, then it has no alternative but to sort of take this kind of path. Now, light's very fast, so this is crazy, in a sense, because this train would be having to go very, very fast for this to seem like a big deal. But it's a thought experiment, so in principle, this is what it would look like. Sally also couldn't have reflexes, she probably couldn't see the beam, but, you know, let's not let reality bother us. So we have that path, and now it all begins to come together, because Sam literally sees this where the height is h, Sally sees the height is h, but now you're taking these diagonal paths, so it is a longer distance. And if you say that the speed of light is the same in both of these, it's going a longer distance here, which tells you that Sally has to measure the time for this phenomenon to go that takes longer than what Sam measures. And the only difference is that they're in different worlds of inertia.
But if the train is accelerating at the time Sam do this experiment, does the light still...
Hold that question for about 20 minutes, and then we're going to get there. So time is relative, not absolute, from this simple example. And we actually looked at it quantitatively, and I don't really want to drag you through that again, but really, we just looked at the geometry for Sally's path and Sam's path, and divided the distance that the light goes in each case by the relevant time. Because C is the same in both reference frames, they're both equal to C. And so we can set these equal to each other and then try to solve for Sam's time with respect to Sally's time. And when we do that, it's just a bunch of algebra. But in the end, we get this as the relationship. And what we find is that the two times are related by this strange quantity, which we call gamma. And gamma is greater than 1 because if something is going much slower than the speed of light, this is effectively 0, and this is just 1. But if you're going a reasonable fraction of the speed of light, then this number becomes bigger but not 1. So 1 minus a number that's not quite 1, but big enough, gives you a small number here, and 1 over the square root of the small number gives you a number of 1. So basically this number gamma is something that is 1 if the velocity with respect to C is small, relative. And so this is the velocity. It's basically this velocity of the train. There's nothing special about that. It's just, remember, in this example, the velocity of the train is the relative motion between these two reference frames. One is pinned to the train, one is to the side of the train. Okay. So what you're really saying is when I try to relate time from one reference frame to another, if the relative speed between the two is v, then this is how to relate them. And this quantity gamma is effectively just 1 if this speed, relative speed, is very small. And that's the world in which we live, because everything that moves with respect to us is moving at a speed that's very low compared to light, which is really, really fast. So if this v is some reasonable fraction of the speed of light, 0.9, 0.8, 0.95 times c, then this number is not negligible anymore, and this gamma becomes big. The closer this is to C, the bigger this number becomes. And so that means if the relative speed is small, these times are equal, and you don't notice this effect at all, which is why nobody cared. But now, once you begin to have things that can move close to the speed of light, this can become an arbitrarily large effect, basically. The time can move at completely different rates. So it's really bizarre.
Yeah. what speeds that we see in like the solar system are not negligible compared to the speed of light? Is anything not negligible?
It turns out that particles, cosmic rays, the particles that come from the sun, that in our atmosphere, those particles are all moving at considerable fractions of the speed of light, and it's a very observable effect. In fact, right now, as you sit here, you have particles called muons that are streaming from the top of the atmosphere and passing through you, called the cosmic rays. And they can affect things. They can actually ionize and cause mutations. They can flip bits in computers. So you can get some sort of random things that happen due to the passage of these particles. And it's a very well understood flux or number of particles that pass through you per second or whatever. You would have more than we see, except the Earth is shielded by atmosphere, the Earth is shielded by magnetic field. So what happens is that most of the particles that are incident on the top of the Earth's atmosphere create showers of other particles. So literally the muons that pass through you are sort of created up at the top of the atmosphere. And if I have a muon and I put it right here and time how long it takes for it to decay into other particles, on average it's a microsecond. And if you calculate how far a muon can travel in 1 microsecond if it travels the speed of light, you find that it really shouldn't reach the surface of the Earth. In fact, it should only travel far away. But because it's going close to the speed of light, in its reference frame, relative to what we see, in its reference frame, the time for it to survive is 1 microsecond. But because it's going so fast with respect to us, in our reference frame, it's longer than 1 microsecond. In fact, it lives long enough to reach the surface. So there's a very real example of strange relativity. Any sort of particle physics experience we're having to do out of those directions. Now we're going to talk a bit more about gravity and those kinds of effects. And it turns out that there it is a big effect. So you have to take into account gravitational effects in general with relativity in order to make GPS work. So we'll get there. We're not there. In terms of special relativity, particle physics is sort of the place where you see it most. Okay. So then there are very real examples. People go out and actually measure this. So with the muon calculation, if you're seeing muons, you can understand things through this, but that's not the same as looking at actual clocks. So you can actually have synchronized clocks and put one on a plane and have it travel around, and you can actually see that the clocks disagree. This is a little bit hand waving right now because, again, if a plane is in a gravitational field, you have additional effects and it accelerates and it's going around in a circle. So you actually are not just testing special relativity with this particular example. But if we confine ourselves to sort of a special relativity example, which we did last time, we can imagine that you have a spaceship traveling at 0.98C, and you have astronomers on Earth that observe the birth of someone on the spaceship by balloons going up in the window or whatever. And they observe the day that they die because black balloons go up in the window. And they mark on their calendars on Earth when the birth and death happen. And if on the spaceship that person lived happily for 70 years and the spaceship just went in a straight line, no acceleration or anything, then we can calculate how long that person would appear to live on Earth. And we did that calculation last time. We got 350 years. So we did that from the point of view of Earth. Suppose you're sitting on the spaceship and we reverse it. You're on the spaceship, you have a telescope, and somebody is born on Earth. And you make a note on your calendar. And then you notice when they die, and you make a note on your calendar, and let's say on Earth they live 70 years. You see, there's complete symmetry in this problem. to the point of view of the person on the spaceship, they're at rest, and Earth goes flying by at 98% the speed of light. So the calculation is in fact identical, depending on your point of view. So the person on Earth, on the spaceship, would see a person on Earth live for 350 years. And these are both true. So what we're doing is we are relating measurement, something that happens in one reference frame to another. So I hope that bothers you. We're going to come back to that, but I want to press forward a little bit before we do. Because if that bothered you, just wait. We can do what we did last time, but instead of measuring how long it takes the light to go up to the top and come back down, we can try to measure the length of the boxcar, knowing that the speed of light is the same in both cases. And so, if you're on the boxcar, then you know the speed of light, you can calculate how long, you can measure how long it takes the light to go, and you can use that to derive a measure of the length of the boxcar. If you're beside the train track, you're going to see something a little bit different, because again, in the time it takes the light to travel and hit the mirror, the boxcar, the other end, has moved, and then it comes back, so you see a different path, all right? Now, I'm not going to drag you through this calculation. I'm just going to tell you what you see when you do this calculation carefully. If you're interested, in fact, many introductory physics textbooks will step you through each of these calculations. And this really isn't any harder than the last one we did, but there's sort of no point. I'm hoping that in dragging you through the last one, you believe, okay, it's not that crazy. So what you find is, in fact, along the direction of motion, the length that you measure also depends on this quantity gamma. And it depends such that if the object is moving relatively slow, relative to the speed of light, past you, you would see no difference between the lengths. You would both measure the same. If it's traveling very fast, in fact, the length you would perceive, if I'm traveling really, really fast with respect to you, and you looked at me, you would perceive me as a pancake, basically, going past you. The direction along the length of motion gets contracted. It's called length contraction. So, we're going to come back to time dilation and length contraction a little bit, but I want to push forward a little bit. Any questions so far? Right. I hope you bothered, because we just threw out your intuition about time, and now we just threw out your intuition about space. Because we perceive space as immutable, it didn't matter what your point of view is, whether you're going fast, slow, or whatever, it's just space. And now what we're seeing is how you perceive that space will depend on your motion. So it's a very bizarre thing. If I fly by in a spaceship going fast enough, a meter stick, you would see much shorter. Okay. Or not okay. It is for me. That's okay. All right. So I hope that bothers you. It bothers everybody when they learn it, I think. It's worse. Okay? So, in order to make my next point, I need to make things a little more complicated. Because what we're really doing is, it's never so simple as, or it's hardly ever so simple as I just measure a time, or I just measure a distance. What you typically are doing is you're measuring something that in your reference frame happens at a particular place and a particular time. And you would measure time by being the difference in time between two events which may or may not happen at the same spatial position or whatever. Maybe it does happen at the same spatial position, but time and space are really both things that you measure. And if somebody is moving at some speed relative to an event, they would also measure that event to happen at a certain time and a certain place. So let us suppose that one of these reference frames is sort of at rest with respect to the event, and the other is moving with respect to the event. Notice that I'm defining their coordinates differently. This one has this happen at position x, y, and z and time t. And the other one, where the person is observing the identical event but is now traveling at a speed v with respect to the event, at the moment it happens, they measure it to be at x prime, y prime, z prime, and t prime. Now, they're moving, so 5 minutes later, where that event happened is in a different set of x, y, z primes. But okay. At the moment it happens, they can assign it a position and a time. And they assign these. What relativity is all about is taking these coordinates and the coordinates in the other reference system and relating them to. Okay? And what we've actually observed are particularly concocted thought experiments that give us a sense of what's going on with the space piece and with the time piece. Okay? And those are useful things. We'll do a little bit more with it. But the world is actually a little more complicated. And so to look at the way in which the complication happens, or the more general case, these things are related by what are known as Lorentz transformations. And here you can see how things are done. What it basically says is that along the direction of motion, things are complicated, and time is complicated, but in directions that are perpendicular to the direction of motion, both people would measure the same. So these are very simple. But if I ask, for example, what this person measures, if this person measured x prime, y prime, z prime, and t prime, it's given by this formula and that formula combined, basically. Let's look at this for a second, because there's a really strange thing here. Here's the gamma factor. This is the thing that gets big if you're going very, very fast with respect to each other. Okay? But notice that the position that you infer over here depends on both the position and the time over here. And the time that you would infer in this frame of reference depends on the time and the position in the other frame of reference. In this picture, you no longer have a clean division between space and time. Because if in our reference frame we measure things with a clock and a meter stick, so we have a very clean separation between the two, if I come flying by in a fast spaceship, those are all mixed up. When I ask, what is the space and time coordinate that I measure? It depends on the space and time, both of what happened in the other reference frame. So they get all mixed up. And what I actually see depends on how fast I'm going. So you can't really think of space and time as being separate at all. And in fact, we don't. We call them space-time.
So this is sort of really where the origin of space-time, and pardon me, I get these slides and sometimes I want to make a certain point and they're just sort of there historically. But so space and time get all mixed up, which is why I'm bothering showing you these general transformations.
So it's a little worse than that. What does simultaneity mean? What does simultaneous mean to you? Two events happen simultaneously. They happen at the same time. So, just let's do a mental example. Let us suppose that on July the 4th, in the United States, we decide that at midnight, at midnight East Coast time, and I'll synchronize our clocks, okay, so West Coasters know that they're 3 hours early. At midnight East Coast time, every town in the U.S. is going to blow fireworks. Okay? Simultaneously. Has a very clear meaning to us. It has a very clear meaning in reality. The people in the space station would look down and it'd be a hell of a sight. They would see fireworks going off everywhere. One year I was actually in a Fermi lab. I was in Chicago. There's a big accelerator there at a lab called Fermi Lab. And at Fermi Lab, they have one of the most spectacular buildings I've ever witnessed. It's sort of a really cool building. I should show you a picture of it. But it has two sides that go up like this, and the middle is mostly glass and a big atrium. So it's a beautiful building. At any rate, I had committed to run one of our experiments there from a control room in that high rise over the evening of the 4th of July. And if you haven't been to the Midwest, it's just flat, completely flat. And so when you're up on the top of this building, you can just see forever. And that was a really cool experience, because I went up to the top of this building, and I watched all these fireworks displays going simultaneously. And, you know, ones that are close be big and bright, and then as they went further away, they'd be smaller and dimmer, and it was really a cool experience. So, at any rate, the people on the space station would sort of see something like that. They'd all go off at once. They'd look down, and there'd be this beautiful sort of thing happening in the U.S. Now, suppose that instead of in the spacecraft, on the space station, they're moving much faster. So you have a spaceship that's zipping by Earth, going at a really high rate of speed. Alright? Now, we all blow the fireworks at the same time. Let's ask what they see. What they would see if we all blew the fireworks at time t prime, all those fireworks are getting blown at different positions. Which tells you necessarily that the people in the spacecraft are going to measure different times for all of these different things going on. So now, even your concept of simultaneity just went out. Two events that are simultaneous in one reference frame are not simultaneous in other reference frames if they are separated in space. So this might even raise issues with causality. In our reference frame, all of these things go off at the same time. In another reference frame, they're going to go off depending on where they are. So you can imagine two events that go off at different times in one reference frame. I can actually pick a reference frame in a direction of motion where I see them happen simultaneously. If these two events are truly independent of each other, I might even be able to find a reference frame. If I'm in one reference frame and they go off this one, then that one, if they are not causally connected, that is, if there's not enough time for light to travel from one to the other, I can actually find a reference frame where I can flip the order of those. I can see the other thing going first. If they happen to be causally connected, and this is actually a very important part of relativity, if I have two events, and say this one goes off and the light from this one sets this one off, okay, then it turns out that I will be unable to find a reference frame that actually flips the time order in those events. So causality, as it turns out, is preserved in relativity. But it's a strange new world. You guys doing okay? All right. Oops, so we talk about space-time. What else did I have in this? Oh, right. Okay, so I want to make some other points. Let me do this one just quickly, because we'll come back to this later in the class. We only talk about space and about time, but I can measure all sorts of things, right? I can measure momentum. I can measure energies. I can measure, you name it. We have to be able to measure. And we have to have relativistic transformations for whatever we measure in one reference frame to another. So as it turns out that if you look at momentum and energy, you get a mathematical relationship between them that is identical to what we get with space and time. So it turns out that if I measure a particle that has a certain momentum and energy, you can think of momentum as mass times speed. If it has a certain momentum in one reference frame and a certain energy, it turns out that the energy and momentum in the other reference frame will be different. And it is this relationship that if you look at what is the energy of something that's not moving, and I won't go through this carefully, you actually find that there's a relationship between the energy of something and mass. And so essentially, one of the other things that came out of Einstein's work in 1907, he had a really great year, actually. He published four papers, two of which were relativity, sort of what we're talking about here. One of which was the photoelectric effect that we'll talk about later, and that's what gave him the Nobel Prize. And the fourth of which was there was an explanation of something which is called Brownian motion. If you were to look at pollen grains in oil through a microscope, what you would find is that they are not static. They actually jiggle. They move around, even if your telescope is stable. And this was known as Brownian motion. And people really didn't understand it because it looked very random. And Einstein analyzed the motion of these particles and was able to basically make the case that these particles are being knocked around by the thermal motion of atoms in the oil. So it was actually a first direct observation of atoms. Up until then, the whole idea of us living in an atomic world was all sort of inferred. Made sense, chemistry was beginning to come together, etc. But there was no real direct sort of clean observation that really could only be explained by the existence of atomic things maybe moving around with the thermal energy. And so that was his fourth paper, which was also pretty spectacular. And perhaps it also was deserving of a Nobel Prize. I don't know,
but it was a hell of a year. At any rate, we will come back to this quite a bit through the course of the semester. It basically says energy and mass have an equivalence, which of course led to the nuclear age. Turns out that this also is the source of energy that drives stars. So it turns out that this basic relationship, we'll study it in a number of different ways, but it's extremely important for sort of our universe and how things hold together. Okay, so that's his paper. Actually, one of the things that's sort of interesting in this is that we talk about space and time and everything, but as I mentioned, what was bothering Einstein was electromagnetism. And if you read German or whatever, this is on the electrodynamics of moving bodies. So he was really talking about electromagnetism in his paper. That was the thing. And it was 1905, not 1907. Sorry. So what else do I have there? Okay. So I want to talk about this in a minute, but let me do this first. Okay.
So a couple of let me make a point, technical point of sorts, and then let's talk about a couple of paradoxes that come out of relativity that are fun.
For Sam and Sally, for the spaceship traveling, we've talked about these reference systems as if there is no preferred or different reference system. We've talked about them being pretty similar. But let's think about that for a moment. For Sam on the train,
his clock is at rest in that reference frame. It's the only reference frame where the clock is at rest on the train. Any other reference frame that you pick, the train is moving in that reference frame and that clock is moving. Or another way to say it is, your clock is moving with respect to the train. Okay? So we would call the reference system
where the clock is at rest. Would be the proper frame. Now you can imagine a clock being at rest in any reference frame. So any reference frame in principle can be a proper frame. So if you're looking to relate one measurement from one frame to another, it's the specifics of how it's asked that determines the proper frame. So if we ask how to relate the event that's happening on the train between Sam and Sally. For Sam, that event happens where he can have his clock at rest. So the event is happening at rest in his reference frame, and that makes it a special reference frame for that event, which we call the proper frame. So if we want to measure a meter stick, there'll be only one reference frame where that meter stick is sitting at rest, and that would be its proper frame. So, if we want to look at the phenomenon of how time changes from one reference frame to another, we talk about time dilation. So that the word dilation means it's getting longer, okay? And the way we can do a calculation is to say, well, I have some reference frame where I measure a delta t. I have another reference frame where I measure a delta t prime. We used primes and not primes earlier in the equations or whatever, but the truth is prime is just sort of a symbol. It doesn't matter. So there's nothing driven about whether it's a prime or not. What is important is whether you have a proper frame. And I call this time dilation, and what it says is that the time for whatever event happens is shortest in the proper frame. And if you measure it from any other reference frame, you'll measure a longer time. So that means that we put the gamma here if this is the proper frame. And in the example we had, as the train goes by, things get squeezed. So in that sense,
on the train is the meter stick. You're at rest on the train. If you observe it from any other reference frame, you see it shorter. So we call that length contraction.
So again, the distance is compared between the two frames, and if this is the proper frame, we know that if we measure it in any other reference frame, we have to measure it shorter. Gamma is bigger than 1, so I know I have to have 1 over gamma.
So if you're just given a problem that, not that you're going to be doing a lot of problems, although I'm asking you to do a few, just to play with this a little bit in the recitation today. You have to, within however the problem is asked, you have to identify which is the proper frame, and then you can put the gamma on the correct side and figure out whether the time measured in the other frame is longer or shorter or whatever. So just be aware of that.
And this is one of the ways in which the problem where we have the spaceship going past Earth, we looked at it from two points of view, but what we did in each of those, we flipped the proper frame, because in one, we're asking what is the
how does the 70 years lived on the spaceship compare to what we could see on Earth? And the other, we ask, how does 70 years lived on Earth, you know, on the spaceship? So in the one point of view, we view the spaceship as the proper frame, and the other point of view, we view the Earth as the proper frame. So it can get confusing. All right, but that's all theoretical. So let's look at it a little bit more practically. Let us suppose that a farmer's son comes upon the farmer, and the farmer is very frustrated, completely frustrated, because the farmer looks at this barn, and he turns out to have a ladder that is longer than the barn is wide. He's very frustrated because he just bought this stupid ladder and can't store it in the barn. What's the poor guy going to do? Son says, "Dude, don't worry. You just paid $18 billion for me to go to college, and look what I have. I can help you out." So the son gets the ladder, puts it over his shoulder, and starts running right toward the barn. Okay? Both barn doors are open. The farmer is off to the side, and as the son speeds up and goes faster and faster, length contraction kicks in. The ladder gets shorter and shorter. And the farmer's like, "Holy crap." So the son goes into the barn, and indeed, the ladder will fit into the barn. Farmer's very happy, closes the doors. Of course, the son blows out the other side because he can't stop, but whatever. All right, but in principle, okay, the son has accomplished what the farmer couldn't figure out. You happy with that? No? All right. So the son's pretty tough, very cocky, took too much physics. So he's running with the ladder, and then he's like, "Oh no!" Because of course, from his point of view, he's at rest, he's got the ladder on his shoulder, and the barn comes flying by at a very big rate of speed. So when he looks at the barn is even shorter. So he can't fit the ladder. Please ride. Well, they're both right. Even though that's painful to admit. But then the question is, how can they both be right? So let us look at it, right? The farmer is happy that the ladder is inside the barn because the farmer sees that the ladder can have each end in the barn with the doors closed simultaneously. Right. So what is the kid's? Indeed, the barn is shrunk. But now, the barn doors, which are simultaneously closed in the farmer's point of view, because they're separated by a distance, are necessarily not closed simultaneously in the kid's point of view. So effectively, the kid is running along, and this barn door is closed. And then before the ladder blows out the front of it, this barn door closes. So from the kid's point of view, yes, both barn doors closed and the ladder sort of went through the barn. But it just looks different. The timing is such that the doors were open and closed. Such that they weren't both closed at the same time with the ladder in there, because that can't happen, because the ladder is way longer than the barn. Okay? Not okay. Strange stuff. All right. Let's do a different one. Let's say that in a few years you have your first kids and you have them simultaneously, so you have twins, all right? And you take your twins, there have been great advances in science, and you're very curious and probably not very apparent. So you take one of your twins and you put them on a rocket ship, okay? That then heads off into space far away at a great rate of speed. So the rocket ship comes back and lands, and the twin gets out. Now, we've actually already did a calculation where we saw that if I measure 70 years on a spaceship going by at 98% speed of light, it looks like 350 in my world. So you can imagine that when the spaceship lands and that twin comes out, less time has passed for them, so they will be much younger than you are, or than your other kid is. Okay? Now, in principle, good enough, but remember, we looked at it from the other point of view, too. The twin gets on the spaceship, and weird universe. The spaceship's at rest, and Earth goes flying off at a very large rate of speed and comes back. So, my twin on Earth should be much younger than I am when we get back together. So this is known as the twin paradox. Two tribes. This one turns out to be unfair, because there's a very fundamental problem with the way that I set it up. There is something that breaks the symmetry between these two frames. Do you know what it is? You're both in this reference frame. You put somebody on a spaceship, they have to go on. To go, that spaceship has to accelerate, right? To get up to speed. Then at the other end, it has to decelerate and then accelerate this way to come back. And then it has to decelerate and stop. So we just completely violated one of the postulates of special relativity. So in fact, special relativity doesn't work at all for that problem. Okay? It would only work for those periods where the spaceship is in an inertial reference frame, relative. So that brings us to realize that things are a bit more complicated, and that to understand the universe well, we need to think about how accelerated reference frames work. But to follow up on that example for a moment, when we do the relativity of accelerated reference frames, which we'll do a little bit up, it turns out symmetry is broken. And in fact, the twin who would come back would get off the spaceship much, much younger. So in fact, their time does travel, does move less. Less time passes on the spaceship than went on. Which is sort of funny because it's time travel. Don't let anybody tell you time travel isn't feasible. Okay, it's not too feasible. We don't have such a station. But in principle, we can. So I can, in principle, send you into the future by having a spaceship that moves at an arbitrarily large speed. And I can tune it. I can calculate and tell you how old you'll be when you get back and what time you'll be on Earth at the time when you get back. But it's a one-way trip, because I don't know how to send you back. I can only I can only send you somewhere where your clock is running slower than everybody else's clock, and then bring you back. So it's strange. So I'm the risk of boring Christina and you guys. When I wrote this book on the multiverse, I had to do a bunch of publicity interviews for trying to sell the book, and it turned out that there was an enormous amount of interest from paranormal blog radio stations, which, being a legitimate scientist, scared the crap out of me. And then I thought about it, and I thought, well, you know, one of the reasons I wrote the book was education and everything, so I should talk with these people. And turned out they were always very nice and respectful, and there was no issue. We got in all sorts of interesting conversations. But, you know, and I was very curious. I mean, we're talking like 40 interviews with paranormal blog radio stations. It was just absolutely ridiculous. And at first I had no idea why there was so much interest in this. And then after about the fifth interview, I sort of figured it out. Because they always ask the same sorts of questions. You know, are ghosts sort of people in other dimensions believing in, or are UFOs popping in from other dimensions? And it's like, okay, now I finally get where you're coming from. And so they weren't very happy with my answer to those things, because basically, as you all know, we define the universe to be that kind of thing to which we're causally disconnected. So that means if I could see something in another dimension or whatever, another universe, then we're causally connected. So it's actually part of our universe. So sort of by definition, the whole multiverse idea is an explanation for UFOs and ghosts. By the way, I define it simply isn't there. So they're always a little disappointed in that. But I also found that if they started to get a little bit strange on me, I mean, I talk to cryptozoologists and all sorts of strange, you know, things. But if they started to go off a little bit, then I would simply tell them, "I'm time travel." Sure, we can do that. They'd be like, "What?" And then all of a sudden, you just talk about relativity for 30 minutes, and the interview's over. So it worked out really well. So I was able to sort of skirt a lot of those interviews that way. And I think they were educational, and I didn't feel guilty, and so it was good. So, at any rate, acceleration. One thing to note is this paper, which was the general theory of relativity, is 1960. So a bunch of years passed between the first paper on relativity and this one. And you may begin to appreciate why in a few minutes. So when you get on an elevator and you press the button, you feel heavier if it's going up. You feel lighter if it's going down. Usually right at the start of the motion, right? Because it's when it's accelerating. If you're in a car and you floor it, you feel thrown back in this, right? So it's accelerating. So you could imagine that if you blacked out the windows in the car or you blacked out the windows in the elevator, how can you really know whether you're accelerating or whether somebody just put a big, massive body behind you and is pulling you back in the seat? And Einstein, as I mentioned, he sort of made his money not on being so incredibly brilliant. His, clearly he was, but his talent to me often was that he could just see the forest in spite of the trees. So Einstein said, well, if you put somebody in an elevator and they have no windows, then we really can't tell whether we're in a situation where the elevator is at rest on the surface of the Earth or whether you're in a rocket ship that's accelerating at 1G. And you're going to measure G in recitation later today. Basically, this is the acceleration that a rock would have when I dropped it. And it's a constant sort of around the surface of the Earth. And a way to think about it is that Earth is pulling on you with a force that's equal to mass times this g, times this value. And if you're on scales, that's also the force that the scales have to push up with you to keep you from crashing through the floor. So, in a sense, it's the force your feet feel when you're standing is driven by the size of that acceleration of Jesus. But if this thing is accelerating with that much, you can't tell the difference. What you feel when the elevator, when you're on Earth and the elevator accelerates upward, what you feel is basically the force of Earth down plus the acceleration up. You basically feel an increase of the force on your feet. And so that's why you feel heavier when the thing is going up. It's the other way around when it's accelerating down. But quite simply, he says, well, we can't tell the difference. So Einstein took this simple idea and calls it the equivalence principle. That there is an equivalence between gravity and an accelerated reference frame. So if you carry this to an extreme, what he says is that by the equivalence principle, I can't tell the difference. So we can look at relativity in accelerated reference frames, and that's basically the same as making a theory of gravity. Because I can't tell the difference under certain, you know, these kinds of circumstances. So mathematically, the theory has to be the same. So this actually leads to some sort of weird things. So for example, suppose we ask, we're in the elevator, and I take a laser pointer that shoots sort of and it shoots a beam, and I just go straight out, and I'm in the elevator. Beams of light, you know, go in straight lines, okay? So let's imagine what this looks like if we are on a rocket ship, okay? As the beam comes out, and we're on the rocket ship, the elevator is accelerating upward. So as the beam goes toward the side, this is moving up relative to the beam of light. And in fact, it's moving up faster and faster because we're accelerating. So what that means is that as the pulse of light comes out, it basically, we would perceive it, if from our point of view in the elevator, as curving. Yes?
So this is like actually happening if you go in an elevator and go up and then this part of you.
Well, as you'll see, it actually happens right now. We just can't measure it. And even if we're not in an elevator because we're on Earth. But so that's the thing. The thought experiment is such that obviously, from this case, the light path has to move in a curve. By the equivalence principle, we are then saying, therefore, light has to move in a curve due to the fact that I'm in a gravitational field on Earth. Which is sort of weird. Okay? So then, he says, if that's true, then light doesn't necessarily go in a straight line. In fact, you have to ask what you mean by that. Light will travel in the shortest distance between two places. And basically, once you sort of realize this is happening, and you want to create a mathematical theory of this thing, you have to ask, how are you going to do that? And one way to do that is to work in a geometry where the space itself curves. And the degree to which it curves depends on the energy that's around it, or the mass that's around it. So a way of viewing this would be that the gravitation of Earth is bending the space itself, such that the light travels on the curve, which may sound very strange. Well, it should sound very strange. I hope it does. If it doesn't, you may be doing the wrong thing. Maybe you're not. So Einstein was very bright, but all of a sudden, what he found himself having to do was to construct a theory of relativity where he had to allow for the space to be curved in a strange way. So mathematicians are really great about generalizing things. And it turns out that the geometry that you and I grew up with and that we find is useful for everyday life where the angles in a triangle sum to 360 degrees, that two parallel lines go in straight lines and never touch each other. I mean, these kinds of things, that a plane is flat. That kind of geometry turns out to be a very special case. You can, if you hate yourself enough, construct geometries and do geometry where the space itself is curved, curvilinear geometries. And there are whole areas of mathematics that are dedicated toward studying this. Now, when Einstein came up with this idea, in fact, people already, mathematicians, are always thinking about these crazy ideas. And one of the things many of you wrote essays this week, I haven't read them yet, but will, and one of the things you're asking, is mathematics real or invented? And this is a classic example of a case where the mathematicians have created this phenomenal series of curved space and geometries and stuff, but it had no reality in the universe as far as we knew, and all of a sudden we have a theory that mathematics is just perfect for it, and it fits it. So then, is it sort of real? Discovered, invented? I mean, I don't know. It's really a fuzzy question, which is why I asked you. I don't know the answer at all. I hope I get some insights from some of you. But I mean, it's strange. Some days I think it's invented, some days I think it's discovered. Honestly. So, at any rate, he had to become an expert in differential geometry to sort of create this theory. And what you find in this theory is that you perceive the force that we feel being drawn toward the center of the Earth in the mental picture in this particular theory. The nature of that force is because we are effectively just following a curve in space-time. It's a very strange sort of way to view it. We're going to talk about other views of forces of nature, which are very different from this one. So we're going to spend some time talking about the nature of forces later. For right now, this one has a very particular conceptual view. And if I'm around a bigger, more massive body, or if I'm around a lot more energy, it turns out that it will curve the space more. It's a little worse than that because, remember, space is not just space. You have space-time. So if you're going to allow the space to be distorted by a mass, you're also screwing around with time. And in fact, if we take a clock and we have another clock and we put them side by side here on the surface of the Earth, and we take one of these clocks and we go way out in space, and we bring it back, they'll have different times. Clocks, time moves slower than gravitational. The bigger the mass, the slower time moves. So, in this view, space and time are, I think of them more as a fabric. You can't really view what's happening in three spatial dimensions and time and how they all distort. But the idea is sort of when you have a massive body, if you were to sort of take your view of the spatial dimensions and condense it down to a two-dimensional plane, you can sort of imagine that the gravitating body is sort of curving in space in such a way that if you're something traveling past here, you'd be drawn in toward that. And that's sort of the conceptual view of gravitation in this particular picture. And it now involves accelerating reference frames. And so, to come back to the twin paradox, if you want to understand the twin paradox, you need to use actual general relativistic equations. Now, I think I just posted, I think I just posted your reading for this week. Within that, there's a very interesting, there are lots of video clips about relativity on the web. I spent a while looking at a bunch of them. And there are some very good ones that about an hour, I want to drag you through one of those, but I've looked at a bunch of them. And this one, I thought, was really very nice. And I have some pedagogical beats with it, but it's got some nice stuff in it. And it has a pretty nice conceptual way of trying to explain the twin paradox. So I do urge you to have fun with that. That's a different story. We'll come back to that. So then, you know, it's our it's science, okay? So in the end, this is one of those examples where human bias, like the experiment, like the theory, the idea of explaining the fundamental aspect of nature in terms of gravity by curved geometry. I mean, how cool is that? Because scientists, physicists today are not that different from the Platos of yesterday, where if you could explain everything in geometry, that would be so cool. String theory is really just that, okay? I think it's on a lot better footing than in the old days, but the sense of wonder and beauty of it that comes out is very similar to what I think, you know, people thought about the Platonic universe with the perfect spheres and stuff like that. So when this theory came out in 1916, it came out to fairly wide acclaim by the science community. But it was years before people could make measurements that had enough sensitivity to distinguish between what Newton's theory of gravity would say, which has a bit of a different conceptual point of view, which in fact we'll talk about next time, and what general relativity would say. But they did. And in fact, one of the first measurements that was done was to look at the curvature of space due to the sun. And Eddington did this, I forget the year, I want to say 1926 or 30, somewhere right in there. So it was a few years later. During a solar eclipse, he looked at the apparent position in the sky of stars. Now, we know where the stars are when there's no sun passing around in front of them. So in principle, we know where they are. And what he found was that a star that was over here in the sky, when the sun came near, he perceived to be over here. Why? Because the light had curved as it went around the sun. And that curvature agrees with what general relativity was telling us. This leads to all sorts of weird, fun things, right? In today's world, cosmology and stuff, people use this as a tool to actually probe deep parts of the universe. So we have something called gravitational lensing, where quite literally we have some massive object we don't even see over here, but we see the light from some distant object coming to us on a bunch of different paths because it comes curved. Sort of like light gets bent by a lens. So we may talk a little bit about gravitational lensing in terms of how it's used as a tool as the course goes on. But there are other things that are quite interesting. This was one of the earliest. There's another, which is relativity predicts that the color of light will change as it moves upward in the gravitational field. That's actually closely associated with the clock speed. If clocks are slower down here than they are up here, when we talk about the color of light, we're really talking about the so-called frequency, which means when we look at the details of what exists, it's made up of things called electromagnetic waves, which we'll talk about, but basically the frequency is the number of times these things will change position per second. And so the per second changes from here to here, which means the color of the light actually changes in a very predictable way. And that is seen. Another thing that's seen is when people do very careful measurements of the positions of the planets. Turns out Newton's law does really, really well with planets, just not perfectly. And there's one thing they could never get right, which is the planet Mercury, these planets move in ellipsoids, and so there's a point of closest approach to the sun, basically, which is known as the perihelion of the orbit. And over many rotations, that perihelion rotates around. So you can see that this one, the perihelion is here, this one, the perihelion is there, this one, the perihelion is there. So the position in space of where that perihelion is, the precession of the perihelion, you might say, is predicted by Newton's laws, and it's predicted by relativity, and in fact, Newton gets it wrong, and relativity gets it right. So it took a while, but right now relativity seems to work. So relativity predicts some other things. You can imagine if I had two huge masses, and let's say that they're moving toward each other and they collide. Okay? We just said that gravity around this mass is sort of the curvature of the space. Gravity around this mass is sort of the curvature of the space. So if they come together or if they're rotating, what it means is that the curvature in the space is changing with time. Right? Space is sort of this fabric. Well, so if I take this system, let's say it's static, and I go, I have just created this big perturbation and curvature in space and time. And that thing will propagate outward just like water waves. If I take a big rock and I throw it in a pond, if I make a big perturbation in the curvature of the surface of the water, that's what we call a wave, and it propagates out. So it turns out that relativity predicts very specific aspects of, if I wiggle stuff, if I change the energy over here, if I wiggle something here, it will propagate out as little waves in space-time, which are known as gravitational waves. These perturbations are not typically very big. If we had a huge star collapse very close to us, we might notice that we're not going to measure it. But in general, for the kinds of events that happen that would cause propagating waves in space, the effects are very small because they're so far away. So remember, water waves, you throw the rock, the waves are very big in terms of their amplitude, right? They're close to the rock. But then as they go out, they get smaller and smaller and smaller. And you can sort of think of that as the energy in the wave has to get spread over a bigger distance. So it has less amplitude. So it turns out that this perturbation in space-time that's happening, which should, in principle, be happening all the time in us, has an amplitude, that is a change in the nature of the space, the curvature, that's about 10 to the minus 16 meters. So that's about 10 times smaller than the nucleus right now, which is really crazy small. But we actually have built devices that, in principle, may reach that sensitivity. There's a big experiment called LIGO, which is currently going on in Hanford, Washington, and a place in Louisiana, where they're actually looking for small distortions of space-time that travel through like waves. So we haven't seen that, but we have looked at things that are rotating, big massive bodies that are rotating in space at very particular times called pulsars. And if that object is radiating away its energy by gravity waves, it has a very particular degradation in the speed of the pulsar, and people have measured that, and it fits exactly what general relativity would say. So it's an indirect measure of gravity waves, but it turns out to, it won somebody a Nobel Prize. Seems to work. Anyway, so, great new world. I'm done. I'm out of time. Yes. Any comments? Questions? Great new world. Okay.
have to go to orientation.
Yeah.